Welcome to episode 338 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Michael O'Malley,
Seth Troyer.
And in today's episode, we'll be talking about things that we saw this week in part one. I don't know why I like mixed up the language on that. Talking about stuff we saw this week in part one. In part two, we'll be kicking off our series on Tilda Swinton with 1986's Caravaggio. Going to talk a little bit of, get into some Jarman action. But let's, you know, we got some good stuff on cinematary.com. We have a new review of The Little Things, the John Lee Hancock, Denzel Washington, Jared Leto, Rami Malek movie that is on HBO Max now, which just looks just awful. Like, it doesn't even look like a fun bad watch. It just looks like you're suffering for 2.25 hours. So Crew Smith, you know, he took the bullet for us on that one, and so he has a good review of that up on the website. But let's go ahead and jump in the movies that we saw this week. And we've talked about a couple of these already, part of the Steve McQueen Small Axe series of films that are on Amazon. But Michael, I know you you went through the five film series, and I finished it up the other day. So let's go through real quickly on all five of them, and I guess share your thoughts on what you made of the series.
Yeah, sure. So I know that you, on a previous episode, talked about Mangrove and Lovers Rock some, and I'm not sure that I have like a ton to say on those two that a lot of people haven't already said. But one of the things that I really enjoyed about Mangrove that is maybe interesting, considering how I ended up feeling about maybe the last movie in this series, which we can get to in a second, is like Mangrove feels like very much like a educational movie where it's like, here, we're going to teach you about like the radical politics of the West Indian immigrant community in London. And that's like explicitly like the thesis of the movie, is like the kind of movie where you just kind of learn about like the history of these characters, but it like makes it so alive and interesting. Like you were just saying off mic, Zach, it's just got this great feeling of community. It's centered around this restaurant called The Mangrove, that is like perpetually like harassed and like destroyed by the police in London, for obviously racist reasons. The police are targeting this restaurant. The movie's kind of all about like, A, why does the community need this place and why is this place so special? But also B, like how does the community basically get radicalized by the actions of the police to defend this place? And so you have like a member of the Black Panther Party just like showing up in the restaurant one day and being like, hey, here's your rights. Here's what you can do. We'll help you in court. And then like the second half of the movie becomes like this courtroom drama that I think works really, really well. Like, it's just I guess there's nothing like exactly like groundbreaking about the way it's done, but it's just like what you imagine a courtroom drama with, like, you know, the objections and the you know, the kind of like tense like hallway confrontations outside of the courtroom. And it's just done really well, while also being like, at least for me, like an opportunity to learn about like community and a movement that I honestly didn't know a ton about before the movie. So anyway, I liked it. It's good.
Yeah, it's the thing I would add, and I think I talked about this when I talked about the movie before, is, you know, it could be construed as being very like by the books, and you know, it's not reinventing the wheel, I guess, when it comes to like courtroom dramas. But I think also like the subject matter itself kind of makes it something unique and different from what you've seen before. You know, just the entire a lot of the ideologies and the politics of it is something that you don't necessarily see on a, you know, covered in a movie narrative or you know, a TV narrative or anything. To me, that was kind of eye-opening. And then also, I mean, the first part of the movie where the police are kind of coming to the restaurant and you have these marches and things like that, to me, that's what was kind of more by the books and not really as engaging. But like you said, whenever it gets into the courtroom, it becomes just that last, like what, like 30, 45 minutes or so is incredibly engaging. Like you're just, you're really on the edge of your seat as like you have these different depositions and such. I feel like Steve McQueen just directs the hell out of that thing.
Yeah, it's so good. While also like enjoyably leaning into like the stuff you would expect out of a courtroom drama where like you have like, I think there's actually a line in the movie where the judge is like, you know, you're on thin ice, prosecutor, but I want to see where you go with this. Like, you know, those sorts of like lines that are just like baked into like courtroom drama, like DNA are there and played like completely straight. And it's just very fun. In addition to being really kind of rousing and moving as well.
It seems like the movie, the courtroom movie that you should be watching instead of watching the Chicago 7 on Netflix. So I'll just say that.
It would be, I would be interested to hear someone who'd seen both of those movies to compare, because they're like strikingly similar on paper.
But yeah, so the next one is Lover's Rock, which Nathan and I talked about pretty extensively a number of weeks back. I mean, we are both fans of it. I mean, what did you think of that one?
I mean, I think it's really good. One thing that I think probably is the trend that I've seen online, at least with like online cinephiles, whatever that's worth, is that this seems to be kind of like the consensus fave as far as like what you know, what people are enjoying the most, and I get that. Like, I think of all the movies, this is the least expository of them. This is the most like cinematic and kind of like the traditional like audiovisual like thing. You know, it is a movie that just takes place over one night, that takes place mostly at a party where people are just dancing at the party. Like, there are other things that go on in the movie, but like, this is such a it's a movie that's full of like, you know, the kind of like hashtag pure cinema moments. And I think it's really good. It's a super vibey movie. It's like one of those like mixtape tech movies, like Dazed and Confused or something like that, where it's basically like constant music. I'm not as familiar with the music as like in, say, Dazed and Confused, but I did recognize a good chunk of the music because it's like, you know, really popular reggae songs, and plus Kung Fu Fighting makes an appearance as well. So there is like a really contagious like feeling to the movie where you watch these people having a great time dancing to this music, and you kind of like are enjoying it with them vicariously, which is maybe, I don't know, like, you know, not to do like the whole like 2020-21 pivot, but like, it is nice to watch people just enjoying themselves at a party and not worrying about like being in proximity to, not being self-conscious about being in proximity with one another. There's something kind of liberating about that.
Yeah. That swings for me from like being very cathartic and exciting to watch to being like very, very depressing to watch.
Yeah. I think what keeps it from being depressing for me is that I probably wouldn't actually be having a good time at this party. I don't really like parties where it's just dancing. I'm not really good at dancing. It's not really my thing. So, like, I think this is probably the best.
What about these people, you know?
Yeah, they're having a great time, and I'm having a great time watching them. And so I'm kind of living the best of both worlds, I think.
Yeah, and I would recommend going back to the episode where we talked about this before, because Nathan gives a really great outline of like what the Lover's Rock movement and all that stuff was and like what it meant for that kind of music community. So if you're interested in like that kind of historical angle, I would listen to that. But I co-sign everything you say. I mean, there's just out of all the movies, I mean, they're all directed really well, but this one especially, like those dance sequences, like Steve McQueen really is just leaning into it, and it's so well directed. And you just kind of have these moments where this will probably be the one that I'll rewatch the most, just because you can get like lost in those, where he'll like play the whole song and you just kind of get lost in the flow of everything, and you have like the flow of the bodies and just all this stuff happening. It's so it just seems like so cliche to be like, it's so vibey, but I mean, that's what it is. And it's really, even if you know, you're like Michael and I, who like, I would also not be like sitting there dancing at that party, but there's something really, really like soothing about like the communal experience of just being able to go somewhere and like have a drink and be around your friends and just be like with people. Like that just seems, that seemed like that part of it seems enticing to me.
Yeah, it's good. And I totally understand why it's people's favorites. It's probably my second favorite. The next one, Red, White, and Blue, is probably my favorite. And I think, Zach, you said it was probably your favorite as well.
Yeah, yeah. I really liked it.
Yeah, and so the next one is a film that is very short. This is like one thing that kind of took me off guard as I watched through these movies, is the first two are fairly... Like Mangrove is like 2 hours, and then Lover's Rock is like a short but conventional length feature. It's like 80 minutes or something like that. And then the remaining ones are all just like an hour or a little under maybe.
This one's around 80. Is it?
Okay, never mind. I guess it's just the last two.
Yeah. The last two are like at an hour. Okay.
At any rate, this one doesn't feel like an hour because this is like, I mentioned the... Lover's Rock is the most like cinematic of the five, and this one feels like the most tightly written of the five. Like it is just a razor focused like character portrait of this one guy played by John Boyega, who
he's based off of a real guy named Leroy Logan.
Yeah, and I think it bears mentioning, like I think all of these films are based off of like real historical movements. The fourth one, Alex Whittle. I'm not familiar with the author, but it's apparently about like the childhood of a well-regarded like young adult author. But at any rate, this one is basically a black man joins the London police force because for the explicit reason that he wants to make it less racist. And so the movie kind of depicts him as a foil to his father. So his father is like kind of seems like a revolutionary, maybe someone who would have been active in the Mangrove fights in the first film, but now he's older and maybe doesn't have that energy in him, but he still is kind of ideologically there. And his son, on the other hand, is kind of like this reform-minded person who thinks that like, I can join the police force and reform it from the inside. And it is a movie like completely and totally about like the psychological toll of that, like being a person who tries to reform this very, at least as the movie presents it, an unreformable institution. And John Boyega himself just gives this like fiery, like utterly compelling performance. Like it's like I think it's probably not controversial to say it's the best John Boyega performance, considering his career is pretty short at this point. But it is great. It's so tightly written. It like ends on this like, you know, conversation that like the movie cuts off like at this one like really interesting part in the conversation, and it just makes the film feel like just razor sharp and like driven in a way that a lot of these small acts movies are not. Like a lot of the small acts movies kind of luxuriate in like the mess of like community. This movie is like hyper precise, and I just really dig that. And it's, I mean, it's pretty depressing, but it's also extremely good.
Yeah, and I think that that's a good, you know, you make a good point that this one's very precise because, like we said, the next two are like an hour long, and you know, this one, it's on Amazon. It's being talked about by Steve McQueen as being a collection of films. But I think just by nature of like how it's packaged in terms of like where you find it in Amazon, it kind of has this not even television show, but like, you know, series type feel to it. Like this, like they're kind of episodes that are all, you know, interlinked to a degree, and they are in terms of the geography and the culture around it. But I think that they all kind of stand alone as their own films. And this one, especially, like, you know, the next two, we can talk about it in a second, but they pose these ideas that are interesting, but they also kind of, they don't give you enough time to really like engage with them. And this one, I think, is kind of like the best of both worlds because it doesn't linger as long as the previous two movies, but it also doesn't it's not as short as the other two, and it really just zeroes in on this concept of he's in the police force. He wants to reform it from the inside, but as he finds, he just is slowly figuring out that it's not about the individuals in the police force. It's the system itself is just up against him, and he is just one person against the system. And if you do some light Google searching of Leroy Logan, you learn about that he has this storied career and is able to make a lot of headway. But I don't think that that's kind of, this isn't like a Oscar bait type of movie that you would see like in America, that it's like, yeah, let's, he struggled through this, but then he was able to overcome, like you mentioned, like it ends in that moment, because it's kind of like McQueen's telling us I don't want the takeaway necessarily to be like, that he dealt with all this, but was able to overcome it and make a lot of progress in the police force. It's more like this is kind of the takeaway, that regardless of what the outcome was, this is what you should be learning about, like what he was having to overcome. And it was making me think a lot about what I was reading after the baseball player Hank Aaron, who just died a couple weeks ago, and just him like reading stories about him where he's recounting like his whole journey through the major leagues. And he's revered now, and he has like statues and plaques and all this stuff, and he's heralded as one of the great baseball icons. But there was this one interview I read, and he was kind of he almost had the effect of like, I kind of, all of this is great, but I also would have appreciated like being able to just have like a normal life and not have to overcome all like things on a daily basis as a baseball player. Like he was having to overcome just constant racism and constant death threats and just threats against his family. And it was just like that finally just wore on him to a degree. And so I was just thinking about that while watching this movie, because it was like there's that elation in going, he was able to make a lot of progress by the end. But I like that McQueen kind of zeroes in saying, yes, that happened and we're better for him, but the takeaway from this lesson should be, this is what he was having to deal with. And I thought that was, an interesting way to kind of frame the story.
I think also like a thematic through line through all of these movies is taking scenarios in which like maybe the conventional narrative choice would have been to highlight like an exceptional individual. The owner of the restaurant in Mangrove, or later on like Alex Whittle or someone like that. But then to kind of position them within a collectivist movement such that like their individual accomplishments are important, but only important such that they contribute to like a community of like a movement within a community. And I think that like Red, White, and Blue is kind of like presenting like the negative version of that, right? Like the individual accomplishments of a person are important, but in the context of like a collective organization, like a police force, it almost doesn't, not that it doesn't matter, but like the thesis is in the same way that, a neighborhood can act as a collective for good, that in a way that like, accounts for, a larger than the sum of its parts of its constituent members, the same is true for a police force in a negative way. And so that's kind of like its thesis against like, the fact of reform. Like an exceptional individual can be exceptional but still not successful at reforming a collective institution, because collective action, whether that's by the state or by a neighborhood or something, is larger than just what individual people do.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's it's kind of tough to frame it in that way, because just the way that we want to, and we as like kind of more collective, like want to engage with narratives, like we want to kind of have that shining star hero at the end of it, you know, like we want to have the you know, lesson where we kind of feel good by the end, and then we have the little, you know, text at the end saying, and then he went on and did X, Y, and Z, and it was all good. But I think that, you know, that's something I appreciate about all of the films in the series, that, you know, it's kind of zero, it just really focuses in on that messiness and how, as you say, like you want to find that like collective action, not just, you know, kind of sitting there waiting for the individual to stand up and do that and believe that's the only accomplishment you can, you know, have. So, I would recommend this as well, like to people. I mean, I would say go through these five movies because they're all pretty interesting, but this one especially. Hopefully, John Boyega gets to do interesting stuff since Star Wars fucked him over.
Yeah, for real. He's so good in this.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
I think you said the same off mic, but I'm a little cooler on the last two, particularly Education. I do think that maybe the first three are the strongest, but there's stuff to recommend about the last two as well.
I'll say about Alex Weddle, which as you mentioned, it's just kind of like a portrait in this like activist writer's life, and kind of it focuses in on like his early on. Like the interesting part of it is him, because he grew up. I'm gonna screw it up because I'm not super familiar with like English geography, but he grew up, one, he was an orphan, and two, he grew up in like kind of foster homes and stuff, but was, you know, based in England. And so then he's like dropped into this West Indies culture in London and is like kind of having to straddle that line between being you know, traditional English, but then you know, Black and West Indies, and like that whole like identity of I'm not Black enough for them, but I'm not, you know, but I'm also, you know, too Black to be hanging around the other side of the, you know, and so like that kind of straddling line I found to be really interesting. I thought the lead actor in that one is really, you know, gives another strong performance as well.
Yeah, he's really good. And then also the scenes, not just where he like struggles to fit in, but he kind of realizes what he's missed, as far as like an upbringing that like gives you a cultural consciousness goes. Those are like really, really sad. Like, as like a foster child in like this like West Indies community, he, you know, people will act as if he knows things or assume that he knows things that he doesn't. And then like, he'll, you know, it's all mostly like physical. Like he doesn't actually say a lot in these scenes. You see this where he has to observe what they're doing and kind of mimic them. And sometimes failing at that, and people will be like, didn't your mother tell you, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And of course she didn't, because he didn't know his parents. And there's just this like, through line of like him trying to figure out like, well, what does it mean to be who I am with the background that I have and yet not being raised with that background? It honestly reminds me a little bit of like maybe the first hour of Spike Lee's Malcolm X, which also deals with kind of like an aimless, disaffected young man who then goes to jail, which is eventually what happens to Alex Weddle, and kind of gains like political consciousness in jail. That, I don't know, I guess there's like a familiar element of the story to me for there, except that, like I mentioned earlier, I don't actually know who this guy is. Like, I'm pretty ignorant of a lot of the cultural touchstones that these movies make, and so I don't know that much about this guy's career. And I do wonder if I would have maybe like been a bit more engaged with the movie if I had kind of understood like who the real life Alex Weddle is and the significance of his writings and things like that. Because I was definitely completely ignorant going in. And maybe the first three movies allow themselves to be more universal or accessible. And this one maybe burrows into a more specific figure. That's just me reading into it, though. I don't know. Maybe this is just not as interesting as the other ones, although it's still good, like I said.
Well, no, like and like I said before, it feels like more than the other three, these last two just kind of feel like episodes in like a mini series where it like touches on the issue, but then it never, like, there's so much more it could be kind of engaging with, and it kind of tries to do the same thing where it kind of like Red, White, and Blue, where it swoops in and it has like this really fulfilling story and then swoops out without like giving the far reaching examination. But I don't think they're as precise with the stories, at least themselves, are as precise to really have that overarching feel, because we can talk briefly about education, but that one is looking at these kind of reform schools that they send a young black student with West Indies descent to, because they said they're saying that he is falling behind and is just not up to the intellectual level to be at a normal school. And so then with the help of these local educational activists, they're able to fight kind of back on that, saying that no, the students are being left behind because of over racial prejudice. But that's one also that you really don't get to that point until like the 40-45 minute mark, and it's only an hour long. So it's kind of tough to really dig into that one.
Yeah, I was going into this one pretty excited because, like, as listeners might know, I'm a high school teacher, and like obviously the educational systems in the United States and the United Kingdom are pretty different in some significant ways. But one way in which they are similar is the fact that, like, a lot of times, like, ideas about like intelligence and student achievement have been either explicitly or accidentally or implicitly coded along racial lines to the detriment of usually students of color. And so I was really interested to see what, like, this movie spin on it, because my experience with the Small Axe movies is taking ideas that I'm familiar with on like a structural level from their American counterparts, but giving me a perspective into a world that I wasn't super familiar with. So, like, you know, kind of understanding racism and police brutality through an American lens, but not, you know, and the other movies being familiar in that way, but then presenting a culture, you know, the West Indies London immigrant culture that is, you know, significantly different from, you know, how racism and police brutality is often framed in the United States. And so, like, a lot of those movies were kind of hitting similar, like, familiar territory, but giving me interesting, perspectives that, like, gave something new. And I guess with education, it just doesn't for me. Like, it, basically the idea that it comes down to is that, like, students of color don't succeed in the British schools because their culture is kind of perceived as like not as educated, and therefore a lot of the stuff that is meaningful to them isn't represented in the educational literature, and therefore it's like this, you know, vicious cycle where then they that kind of sometimes results in students not being as high achieving and et cetera. And I just felt like the movie didn't do anything beyond that, like, very basic idea, which I'm already kind of familiar with there. And this is compounded by, like you said, Zach, it being a kind of short movie and not really fully developing what's there. Like, there's this really great child protagonist played by a young actor that I can't remember the name of the actor, but it's a really great performance for a role that essentially disappears 2/3 of the way through the movie. And only kind of reappears to, like, show, like, how magically he's become, like, a much more proficient reader because he's found education that engages him. And, like, that's a really inspiring way that the movie, like, journey for the movie to take, but I don't think the movie actually takes that journey. It kind of goes from point A to point F really quickly and in a way that didn't give me that much to work with, I guess.
Well, you also have like the kind of, you know, the money scene. You know, you have that scene with his mom and his sister where he's like trying to read and she's like recognizing that he just is unable to. It's not, it doesn't have anything to do with his intelligence. He just doesn't have that skill set, and that's what's kind of, and like you have this really emotional moment, but that comes at the 50-minute mark. You know, you got 10 minutes left, the movie's over. And so it's just kind of tough to really like latch onto it.
Right. And I think it was really like, it's really smart how the movie builds the protagonist. And the reason why like his mother, for instance, doesn't realize that he can't read until later on is that he's really, as students tend to be, like is really adept at like deflecting the, his, you know, kind of ability deficit by, you know, using context clues and stuff. So like he'll have someone else read something for him, and then kind of act as if he knew how to read it all along. And it's, and like, it, there's some really interesting and smart, like character insights early on in the film. But yeah, like by the time you get around to like growth from those initial insights, there's just not much left in the movie. I wonder, part of me wonders the fact that it's the last two that are so short, like, I wonder if there was some sort of deadline or budget constraint that like made these movies smaller than the rest. Maybe I'm just being uncharitable and this was just Steve McQueen's vision. But it does feel striking that the last two, at least for me, are the weakest and the shortest as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like, hey Steve, we need these movies and can you hurry it up a little bit? But yeah, no, I was into the subject of both of them. I kind of wish, they could have been at least 80 minutes, you know? So, but at the very least, I would highly recommend if you have Amazon Prime, checking the all five of these out. I think they're worth seeing. And I mean, I had Lovers Rock, I think in my favorites list of the last year, but I think, like I said, Red, White, and Blue would be there as well. And Mangrove kind of on the outside. So good stuff.
Yeah, I agree. It's totally worth watching. Even if I'm not super excited about the last, especially the last one, I think that as a whole, these movies really play off of each other interestingly, and totally worth watching all of them all the way through.
Yeah, absolutely. Seth, you had a movie you want to talk about?
I was going to talk about The Wanting Mare by Nicholas Ash Bateman. I did a review for it for Cinematary. We were talking before we started recording, and Zach, you mentioned that it's like, it's, I didn't hate it, but I don't know what to say. It is a tough one to put into words. It's a fantasy post-apocalypse world that this director has created. It even has a cool fantasy name, Withren. And it's this strange, like, the world has been decimated by unnamed environmental issues. And it seems like this, like, city that's along this coast is, like, a last holdout. But the city itself is, like, seems kind of like it's anarchy or something. And they are all fighting over these, like, these tickets that get you onto ships, which like the ships take, they're like this city's like main export is horses, and they take the horses to this apparently like otherworldly mystical land. It's kind of unclear. It's just more so that they want to get somewhere else, and they're willing to like fight for these tickets to do so, to get on the boats. But really, like, talking about the plot itself is kind of like, its structure is really what's interesting, I think. And it's this multi-generational story. It's like told over like the course of decades. It's for me, like, it feels like it's the like it's like a fantasy series that could have been like expanded for like books and books and books, and like Netflix series after Netflix series, like explaining every little detail of how they did every little thing and how the world works and stuff. But they just like cut all that out, made a 90-minute movie out of it, which sounds like a, like I'm giving it a critique, but personally I kind of love that, because some of like I lust after like fantasy novels and stuff, like the idea, like I look at those like covers and I'm like, this is gonna be awesome. And then I'm like oh, there's like 8 books in this series, and like actually a lot of like the plot mechanics are just like walking and like traveling and whatnot. It's kind of great. Like what I really want, and what I think a lot of people really want out of like fantasy and science fiction, is like to be just like in that world, just be like kind of bathed in the atmosphere. And that's what this thing does for sure. And that's sort of like the way to ride it, I think. Like rather than like, cause you can, it's definitely strange. Like it's, a lot of it is not necessarily like explained as to how everything is working. And you can really get like caught up on like, wait, who is that? How is she like linked to this? And wait, how does this work in this world? You kind of got to like sit back and let it happen, I guess, and get lost in it. And that's what I really think about it.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best advice, because it is like, you're not going to really, it's all about kind of letting it like roll over you. You're not going to really find many like concrete, tangible answers to anything, because it just kind of tosses all of these very abstract concepts kind of at you. And then, but also just really builds this unique space that you're in. It's worth mentioning that the director, and correct me if I'm wrong, he did like, was it art design or set design or something for Shane Carruth and his movies?
Visual effects.
Visual effects. Yeah. So it's very much like in that mindset, that mold.
Yeah, it does kind of remind me of like that like the ghost story, how it's like the it's like a like the how Shane's ghost story is kind of like a really odd approach to like a traditional ghost story. This is also like just as much of like a totally like throw the rule book out like approach to like a science fiction movie. And it also has like a similar sort of like emotive quality. Like the emotions are really like at the heart of this. And that's really what you find yourself tethering, like tethered to. But I know it like came out like, I think it came out like last week or something. But I hope people are going to be able to like, if they're not going to theaters right now, I hope they're able to like get this out there, get it into people's, get it on people's screens. I was like, I just think it's so nice to see like something that is science fiction or fantasy, but it's not like an adaptation. It's like from this guy's brain.
And it's not like, you know, tossing in, like, it's not setting up 6 other movies in a franchise, like, you know, it's just it's just a nice little 90-minute weird movie, just let it live.
Yeah, they took the 6 movies they could have made and put, there's like 6 movies worth of plot in this thing, but it somehow doesn't like feel like it by the end. I don't know. I know he was like originally pitching it like I think he has like a whole like world like written down and whatnot. He was like originally pitching it as like a multi movie deal, like he was going to make more movies in this world, which sounds nuts, like, which I mean maybe it'll happen, but I don't know. They'd probably have to drop like some kind of existing property into it, like Smurfs.
There you go. The wanting Smurf mayor, that's what we need.
Definitely. That's what they find when they get over to the other continent, just Smurfs on horses.
Well, I think it's on. I think it's on demand and all those places now. So, yeah, check it out and check out Seth's review on cinematary.com. But we're gonna take a quick break, and then we'll be back with part two to talk about Caravaggio after this.
Hey, Cinematary listeners, Andrew here. At the midpoint of this week's episode, I want to direct you to some of the non-podcasty things we have to offer. First, if you're a fan of what we do, please consider supporting us on Patreon. For $5 a month, you get three things: a shout out at the end of every episode, the opportunity to choose a movie we cover on the show, and our Patreon exclusive podcast, Film Theory and Chill, in which we look at a piece of theory once a month, deconstruct it, and then just chill out, talking about whatever else we have going on. All Patreon support goes solely to paying our writers for their reviews that go up on our website every Monday. Also, at the bottom of cinematary.com, you can sign up for our free newsletter. Every Sunday, we send out an email with the latest podcast episode, Patreon content, and written reviews. This is perfect for those who want to keep tabs on what's happening, but might be too busy to see the posts when they go up. Before I go, one more quick thing. The easiest thing you can do to support us is to give Cinematary a rating and review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to the show. This is quick, free, easy, and we will read your review out on the show once we get it. To recap, consider donating to our Patreon, sign up for the free newsletter, and please give us a rating and review. Thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show.
Of episode 338 of Cinematary. In this part, we will be kicking off our Tilda Swinton. All right, I was struggling. Swinton. I was getting.
It's gonna be a long series if you can't pronounce.
Yeah, and I felt like I was getting really southern with it. Tilda Swinton series with 1986's Caravaggio. It's directed by Derek Jarman, from a script by Jarman, Susio Cecchi D'Amico, and Nicholas Ward Jackson. The film stars Nigel Terry, Sean Bean, Tilda Swinton, Dexter Fletcher, and Michael Goh, and this fictional portrait of Italian Renaissance artist Michelangelo Merisi da Caravaggio follows the painter as he wanders the streets, often using prostitutes and homeless people as models for his work, which was lauded in his own time. Involved with two very different lovers, Renuccio and Lena, Caravaggio leads a troubled life in spite of his relative success, with his reckless behavior steering him towards an early grave. In keeping with Caravaggio's use of contemporary dress for his biblical figures, Jarman intentionally included several anachronisms in the film that did not fit with Caravaggio's life in the 16th century. In one scene, Caravaggio is in a bar lit with electric lights. Another character is seen using an electronic calculator. Car horns are heard honking outside his studio, and in one scene, Caravaggio is seen leaning on a green truck. Cigarette smoking, a motorbike, and the use of a manual typewriter also featured in the film. Remarking on this, Jarman said, quote, "People tend to think that history is immutable, that there is something called reality. Reality is what interests me, that image of reality in Caravaggio. Why is a Ken Loach film more real than a Ken Russell film? And why is Italian neorealism more real than Michael Powell? For me, the answer is that they aren't. I actually see the news on television as fiction. People say reality, but what they forget is that the streets they walk through come out of people's imagination and are not real in that sense." The film was also the first time that Tilda Swinton worked with Jarman. It was one of her first film roles ever. In 1986, the New York Times said Caravaggio is an experiment in excess, but with enough flashes of ingenuity and visual brilliance to repay a visit. And in 1986, the Washington Post said, "I may be a dull fellow, but from the beginning of Caravaggio, I hadn't the slightest idea as to what Jarman was up to." And in 2005, The Guardian said, purely on cinematic terms, Jarman's film is a bit of a curate's egg. Arguably the most accessible of his films, it remains a testament to his distinctive visual style. So on that note, let's jump a little bit into Caravaggio. Yeah, what did you all make of it? Seth, what did you make of the film?
Well, that quote from Jarman is just like, it's just gospel to me. I just love that. Like, because that's what I love about this movie. And it's like something that I adore in a lot of like film. Like this movie reminded me, like the way it's presented, it's like, it definitely brings like biographical like material here, but it's just kitchen sink, like whatever he wants to throw in, he throws in, and he's not concerned about realism. It reminded me a lot of Gus Van Sant's My Own Private Idaho, not just in like that it's like really gay and like got street kids in it, but it's like that kind of like, 1 second they're speaking in like Henry VIII, like Shakespearean verse, and then the next second they're like yelling about Santa Claus. Like the same thing occurs in this movie. Like 1 second it's like very straight laced, like you almost think it's a regular biopic, and then suddenly you're very aware that like on purpose you're like being shown like a set, like it's clearly like a warehouse. Like that's what was also like really intriguing. It felt like they were like, it was like a bunch of people playing dress up in like this big art warehouse or something. Cause like you never see like the outside. It felt very fantastical for that reason. I think it's like almost all sets, but yeah, I didn't know a lot. It's like, you don't really need to know much about Caravaggio. You don't really know much about Caravaggio by the end of the film, and it's more like, and that's okay. Like it's more like a film in the key of Caravaggio, sort of like how like I'm Not There, like the Bob Dylan movie Todd Haynes made, is like, it's Bob Dylan is never mentioned in the movie, but it's about Bob Dylan, right? Like it's in the feeling of Bob Dylan. Yeah, I dug it for sure.
Yeah. Michael, what did you make of it?
I went in just knowing that Caravaggio was a painter, but not that much else. And so I was pretty confused at first about like when the time period was supposed to be. And once I realized that it was like intentionally playful, I was kind of delighted, but I was also kind of delighted that I was taken in by the film. Like I just kind of like, when I saw like a motor vehicle, I was like, oh, I guess this guy must've been a 20th century painter. And I just didn't know that. Interesting. And I feel like in a way, like Jarman would be a real big fan of the fact that like, I was just kind of taken in at first by the fantasy of the film. I guess I like that it's a movie that, like Seth was saying, is just so kind of, like, wild and unpredictable with the pieces that are put together. I feel like you could contrast this with, like, who's the guy that did, like, the Tesla movie with Ethan Hawke and then the Experimenter movie? You know, that those movies are interesting because they also use, like, anachronisms, but they feel just so, like... they feel like very considered anachronisms. You know, we're going to have Ethan Hawke's Tesla talk to the camera or have him sing a Tears for Fears song or something like that. And like, this just felt so unhinged compared to some, like the kind of usual anachronisms I'm used to. And that made it like, not just fun, like, although it was fun to see that, but kind of a kind of unpredictable and even like kind of a scary movie, not scary in the sense of like scary things happening, but like a cinematically scary movie, if that makes sense, where it's like you're unclear like what is, like it's surprising in an unnerving way some of the things that the movie ends up doing, like the fact that it like left turns into like a murder melodrama for like 15 minutes for a while, or that like there are moments that are just kind of like slow cinema where you're just kind of watching someone being painted in these really like slow, languorous shots. And then it'll all of a sudden like kind of juxtapose this with like kind of 80s like underground alternative culture from like London or whatever. Like there's just like, it's a really discordant movie, and there's a lot of like dissonance in ways that I sometimes feel like movies get kind of cute when they're trying to do anachronisms, but this movie didn't feel cute. It felt like really chaotic. It had a super chaotic energy that I liked, while also being a really thoughtful movie as well. Like I mentioned, it's at times like really like slow contemplative movie. But it does that without feeling stodgy to me. It feels kind of like off the cuff and unhinged in interesting ways, which is maybe, I mean, if we're talking about this being like about Caravaggio or in the mood of Caravaggio, that's at least how the movie presents the artist of Caravaggio. I don't know anything about the dude in real life, but it's coherent within the framework of its characters that the movie itself has that attitude, which I admire and I think is cool. Also, Tilda Swinton's really good in this, so since this is a series about her, throw that in there. It's super... I don't think I've seen any movie within 10 years of this that was starring Tilda Swinton, so it was super weird to see her so young. But also, like, she's extremely good and, like, really electric on screen.
Yeah. Well, before we talk about her, I do want to talk a little bit more about, you know... kind of the quote from Jarman, as well as just the kind of how it tackles the historical nature of this, because I think that is an interesting, like the way he phrases it in that quote, it's interesting just because, you know, I think that there's a way people watch movies in like it has to be so married to not only whether it's a historical moment, but also just like the text it's coming from. So if it's, you know, being adapted from a book or a play or something like that, there like has to be this level of like, you have to bring it word for word to the movie screen. Like that's what you're looking for. And so to me, I was thinking about that and going, no, I mean, that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. You know, it's all about the kind of the experience within the narrative that's happening in the movie. And so, I mean, to y'all, what, like, do you think the movie would have been better or worse if it was just like a straight biopic of Caravaggio, like the life he lived, rather than kind of how we're describing it, you know, kind of playing with history to a degree? Do you think it would have made it any better?
No, I don't think it would have been worse. Like I'm going to say unquestionably, it would have been worse. I watched, there was a period of about 24 hours of like liminality with this podcast where we weren't sure if we were going to watch Caravaggio or The Last of England, which is another Jarman movie that has Tilda Swinton in it. Turns out only about like 10 minutes tops of Tilda Swinton. So we did this movie instead, but I ended up watching that The Last of England, which is, like I mentioned, another Jarman film. And it's another Jarman film that plays around with textual sources and stuff. It is an avant-garde film. Like, it's a, like, kind of in the style of, like Man with the Movie Camera or something, where it's, like, a giant montage of, like, shots and stuff. But one of the interesting things is that at certain points it will seem to become, like, an adaptation of, like, a... Or it will appropriate like these really famous poems. Like at one point, like Howl gets read, but you know, the Allen Ginsberg poem. And at another point, bits of like T.S. Eliot are read and stuff like that. And so like one of the things that comes out of that movie is like this kind of like collage effect of like all of these different like voices colliding with each other. And ultimately like the portrait of like, like in some ways, it's like a, it's about like the kind of simultaneous like rise of like the HIV epidemic and then like Margaret Thatcher's like kind of conservative austerity, to the extent that the movie's about anything. And so you get these like almost three-dimensional portrait of like the experience of living that, because you get all these voices that are colliding with one another, and the movie itself seems to accommodate all these voices. And I think that in a more conventional way, Caravaggio is doing something similar, where it feels like a more dynamic portrait of something, because all of these things are colliding with one another. You get like the intersection of all these things that you wouldn't normally see intersected. And that makes the movie feel, at least for me, a lot more interesting and a lot more dynamic. The fact that we can kind of imagine like Caravaggio in the context of 20th century England, at the same time that we're imagining like the Renaissance Caravaggio, is like a fun, like not just fun, but like interesting and productive tension for the movie. That it seems like Jarman like goes to that, what, that kind of tension a lot, like based on this and The Last of England. That's my take. I would not want to see the version of this movie that's not playing around with like conventions of reality.
Yeah, I love the approach that it's more like about the aesthetic is of Caravaggio's like paintings, or the aesthetic of the time periods that are being expressed here, rather than like trying to get it like perfectly right. And I definitely like its rejection of realism and like not caring about that guy who's in the theater who's like, oh, technically, like a cardinal in the Catholic Church would never dress like that or something like that, because like, who cares? Who gives a shit? But at the same time, I think I can imagine there are directors, given the right resources, could make like a really good, like accurate Caravaggio movie, right? But they would be, if they were playing perfectly to their strength and using the whatever resources they have properly. I think Jarman is like, this is an excellent lesson in how to use, like, this wasn't like a huge budget movie, obviously, and he's using, but he's not letting that deter him at all. He's like, okay, I will definitely not be able to afford to make this like absolutely period, so throw that out the window. But it's not a deal breaker for him. He goes like straight ahead into this like sort of like wacky, unhinged surrealism with it, because it's what he can do, and he knows it's like goes with his strengths. And I kind of like that. It's very fearless.
Yeah, absolutely. And that kind of, you know, leads into talking about Tilda Swinton in this movie, because I think that she, you know, she kind of has this quality that it feels like she's also kind of straddling those two lines. Like, she completely fits into the more decadent, like Renaissance period, time period aspect of it, but then also like seems completely at home, you know, in like the period dress, smoking a cigarette, which like is one of the scenes that I kind of enjoyed out of this movie.
Oh yeah.
And so, I mean, what did you all make of her performance? Because I feel like out of the ones, the main characters in this, she just kind of seems to be the one like openly embracing like these two straddling lines.
I do, like, when I think of Tilda Swinton, I think of like a performer who has like a chaotic energy to her, while also being like in some ways like extremely mannered and considered. And I think that that's like a really good fit for this movie, where she does like really feel like a live wire, like her character does in this movie a lot of times. And like the plot twists toward the end of the movie kind of bend around like what happens with her character, and I think that like works well. But then also like she has a kind of theatricality to her that feels like it fits within the context of like Renaissance painting. Like I think about like is Caravaggio Baroque? Is that like kind of what he would be considered?
No, I mean, he's a Renaissance painter.
Is he? Mm-hmm. All right. But like the lighting and stuff that we see are like scenes that seem very staged, while also having like, you know, kind of really striking like lighting elements and things like that. And I think like Tilda's performance like does both of those things, where she's able to kind of like thrive within the staginess of like what it's asking her to do. You know, like she exists as part of this like kind of artistic like collective that is allowed to exist within the church, this like kind of like almost hedonist like artistic collective, but she's also able to pivot into like the like aesthetic of the art as well. And like the movie as a whole, like I really enjoy that tension between like the kind of chaotic fringes of it with the kind of mannered elements too.
Just such a good job with like this is where we can start to see like her range, sort of, because she is like kind of the only like, so they're like sort of this threesome of like weird artists who are all like kind of like having sex with each other, kind of using each other in different ways, but she's the one who is actually like, she changes by the end of the movie. Like she's the only one with like an arc, kind of. Like she is making plans. We can see her like sort of transform by the end, which is kind of like it's kind of exciting to watch, especially in comparison to like, I don't think like for her being sort of like, at first you might think she's sort of like this minor character, and she's not necessarily like in the movie a ton. She's not like the focus. Like I remember we were like not sure if we wanted to like talk about this or not because she wasn't in it like all that much. But what is really cool about her performance is like there's almost like a, I don't know, she like grows from a minor character to a larger like character, like a larger piece of the pie, who like oh shit, like she's holding all the cards by the end, kind of. And it's kind of cool to watch her do that very subtly.
Yeah. Well, she also seems to, you know, it's kind of like she, like the change that you're talking about, it's like she kind of gets caught up in the shifting, you know, the shifting landscapes between, you know, the more modern amenities and the Renaissance qualities, which kind of plays into, you know, I think it was mentioned, and I mentioned it in the notes a little bit, but like, you know, Caravaggio's paintings, which Michael, you were correct, he does kind of encompass a little bit of the Baroque period.
That was completely by accident. I was pulling out a word and I was like, I just pulled an art word out. So
yeah, it's a little bit, bad. it's a little bit of the Baroque period, but like his artwork especially is well known because, he like would have these figures, these biblical, scenes. I think the most well-known one is his, painting of Doubting Thomas, which I would recommend doing a quick Google search on and looking at it, because like the way that like the skin of Jesus is cut when he's like touching it is just,
oh my gosh, is that one? Oh, I know that one. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's an insane painting. But a lot of it would have these like biblical figures, and but it would have it like in the dress of like the Renaissance period, you know, that 16th century dress. And so like that's kind of what was provocative about him, is that he had like this you know, he's putting these figures that are hailed as these you know, sacred spiritual figures, and is putting them in like a dress that people would see, you know, in the market or what have you. And so you know, the like just kind of that sensibility, that mirroring of like two kind of time periods all in the same place. I think that's something, at least, you know, to your point about Tilda Swinton, it's like she just kind of has this chameleon ability to kind of blend in. And I think here she kind of utilizes that to kind of play between the two periods of time that Jarman's working with.
I think another thing that works really well about that, and again, like pulling from like what I saw in The Last of England, which is the only other Jarman movie I've seen, is that's kind of like an anti-nostalgia movie. Like in some ways, it's like an elegy for like the death of a certain kind of England. But in other ways, it's like just a real, like almost like a sacrilegious take on it. Like there's a shot in the movie where two people are having sex on like the Union Jack. And like just kind of a like middle finger at the pieties of tradition while also having a kind of affection for like the kind of collective, like the collectivity of a tradition. And I think that like a lot of traditional like biopics, when you're dealing with like a historical figure, are really pious about like their time period and pious about like, you know, how they want to portray people. And that's a lot of times, I think, what makes some biopics pretty stuffy and uninteresting, is that there is like a, there's almost like a reverence to this, to the subject matter, that like kind of kills the spirit of movies kind of. And this movie is not that, you know, like there, it's not a pious movie. It's not a movie that feels the need to like place people where they are kind of expected to be. And the fact that Tilda Swinton, like you said, Zach, is like, there's like a chameleon quality to it. She's an actress who, it's difficult to kind of pin like where should she be. You know, she's got, if you look at her career, you know, something like We Need to Talk About Kevin is like a relatively grounded role and like kind of like a kind of contemporary like psychology or something like that. And then, you know, she goes all the way to like you know, Chronicles of Narnia, doing like this really kind of like outsized, you know, high fantasy, to then something like this, or like straight like avant-garde like art object in The Last of England. Like there's the fact that she as a career like is kind of an unplaceable performer, I think works well with like the idea of like undoing like the piousness of like putting people in their historical place, I guess, that this movie's kind of unraveling, and Jarman seems to be interested in unraveling in general.
Yeah, like definitely like straddling like more than one thing at a time, I think, like which like Tilda does, like is always referred to like pretty frequently as like androgynous and yeah, like a chameleon and things. And this movie just seems perfect for her qualities, because it also kind of echoes that feeling, because it's like it's expressing like this sort of like high culture like kind of thing, is about painters like hoity-toity painting like that people talk about, but like it's done in this like punk rock sort of way, which is also, yeah, there's also like this doubling sort of thing going on with the paintings themselves, where like she is like, there's like a scene where she's like basically, is she a, necessarily a prostitute in the movie?
I don't know.
Yeah, I know they're like homeless, her and the Sean Bean character.
Yeah, but she like poses as like Mary, like Mother of God at a certain point. Like they're all like sort of doing this like, no one would ever know, like once that portrait is in like the cathedral, that this like that it was like Tilda, this like poor woman of the street, like posing as like Mary, Mother of God or whatever. I think it's just kind of a fascinating like thing to straddle.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of interesting just in terms of looking at this now and then kind of thinking about her more recent career, because I think you hit on it, Seth, but she does kind of have this almost kind of label on her. You know, you, Michael, you named off a few of the movies, but you even look at something like, again, incredibly recent with like Snowpiercer or Okja, or really any of her roles in like the Wes Anderson movies. I also think of her like in Hail Caesar, where it's just almost like there's this absurd, seems like kind of like a harsh way to put it, but like there's like this absurdity almost to it. Like she, you know, she kind of has like these very like dynamic these dynamic characters. And so this one was interesting because it was kind of like she was like able to, you know, have that chameleon quality, but also have this very like, you know, a role that kind of had a mold to it. You know, it seems like more recently people are just kind of tossing her in roles that allow her to just kind of go all over the place. And so it was kind of interesting to see something more restrained like this.
I forgot to mention Suspiria, where she plays like 3 or 4 roles.
Oh, yeah. That's true. You're right. How can I forget about the recent Suspiria?
It's an unforgettable.
There's like a bunch of Hildas in it?
She plays like 3 roles. Some of them are unrecognizable because she's under so much like makeup and prosthetics. But
whoa.
Anyway, she's recognizable in this movie for sure. And like I said, I hadn't seen like kind of pre-fame Tilda, a pre-fame Tilda performance. And so it's super interesting to go back and look at this and see, like, in some ways that her style has become a bit more like mannered and eccentric. And this feels a little bit more raw and like unrefined. But in other ways, like, this is a much more interesting performance than, you know, maybe her blockbuster kind of performances, which are maybe like, I mean, I love Tilda, but maybe some of it, like, Suspiria is a little bit kitschy, maybe. I don't know.
The one last thing I wanted to talk about with this movie is that it again, kind of breaking away from being like a traditional biopic, like it has this really interesting view of like the politics of art. You know, I think that's something that kind of gets a little bit lost, but you know, you have like this kind of given this relationship between the church and Caravaggio, which is a pretty pretty staple relationship for a lot of artists and painters and such at that time. But I think it also, you know, as it kind of jumps between these time periods, you know, I think there's also a connection you can make in terms of just art outside of just the art in that kind of sense, you know, whether it's theater or movies or television or what have you. It kind of has like this nice commentary on like the art versus commerce type discussion that I, at least for me, I was kind of finding it to be interesting.
Well, I was just going to say, have either of you guys ever seen Andrei Rublev, like the Andrei Tarkovsky movie?
No, but it's on my list.
Yeah, you know how the... It's, I mean, you know, if you're interested in like a 3-hour slow cinema film about how art reflects the character of the formation of the nation of Russia, it should be top of your list. Yeah. But the interesting thing I was...
And it's badass.
Yeah, it's a good movie. It's a great movie. The thing I was thinking of is like the very end. I can't imagine this is like actually a spoiler. It's just like the kind of this is just the aesthetic that the movie ends on. Like the whole movie is black and white and mostly like very silent. Like it's a movie with not a ton of score or anything like that. But the last, I want to say like the last 5 minutes of the movie is simply just shots of the work. It's about an artist like this movie. In the last like 5 minutes of the movie is shots of the artist's work in color. And then, so you get kind of like this, and they're the modern version. So they're aged and stuff like that too. They're not recreations of like what it would have been in medieval Russia or whatever. And so you get this really interesting, like dynamic between like, you see like the art being formed in the text of the movie, and then in the last few minutes you see like what it is now, and there's like this idea of like what does art mean in different contexts and different time periods. And anyway, what you were saying, Zach, about like the way that this movie kind of like, you know, uses the shifting time periods to imagine like how art's stance toward the world like kind of shifts in different contexts based on like the politics of the moment and the context of the time period, like it made me think of that, maybe more so than it would have otherwise, except that this movie does kind of evoke Tarkovsky at certain points with like some of the slower like painting moments. as well. I don't know. It's not like a fantastic double feature between these two, but that's the connection that
it'd
I was
be a long
of.
One.
It'd be super long.
But I definitely see what you're saying, and that's definitely it's really subtle in this movie, but it goes all the way through it, even down to like what we're saying about how it's like it's unapologetically like non-traditional biopic in the way that it like it doesn't really worship Caravaggio. Like that's like I think a lot of people's problems with like biography is like quite often like these biopics just like paint everybody in this like larger than life, they were such a beautiful like legendary person or something like that. They like specifically do not do that here. You like barely get to know this character, and there's like one line at a certain point where like they talk to the like, is it the cardinal or the pope, and the pope himself like kind of like cuts to the quick and says like basically like, yeah, you guys think you're like revolutionaries or something, but like we own you, we control the art, we pay for the art, like no revolution has ever been fought with like paintbrushes, I think he says, which I think was really interesting. I think the same thing is like true, like these were like revolutionary pieces of art, and that the same thing happens with like Hollywood and whatnot. There's still like this like ceiling over everything that is like we're only gonna allow like what we want to allow here, and like we're still in control and whatnot. I thought that was a really interesting part of this movie.
Yeah, it's just something that I think it's a little bit it's not as interesting to explore. You know, again, going back to the point of like if this was a more traditional biopic, you'd probably gloss over it. But I think that just that relationship that art has to have with commerce and especially like an institution like the church. You know, I think it's just, like you said, it's kind of a subtle but also a pretty impactful point that Jarman makes in this one. Any final thoughts on Caravaggio before we wrap this one up?
It's good. It's good. It's on Canvas. I don't know how many people in Knoxville are listening, but if you're not getting Canvas through the Knox County Library, you're missing out. Good streaming service, and you can watch this movie
maybe
there.
Canopy or Canvas?
I'm sorry, Canopy. I'm sorry. I'm a teacher, and we use Canvas as a learning platform.
He's got the art on the brain, yeah. You know? He's thinking of
Canopy,
a painting canvas.
Forget what
That's
I said
okay.
about Canvas, which is dumb.
Right.
Canopy is great. Great streaming service that has a lot of Jarman movies, including this one, also including The Last of England, which is the other one I mentioned.
I noticed one other thing about this, and I can barely find anybody who's willing to cop to it, but there's like a bunch of stuff from this movie that is like in the REM, like Losing My Religion music video. I found like some stuff where the music video director says he was influenced by Caravaggio the painter but not by the movie, but it seems really like I don't know, it seems like it wouldn't be like too far-fetched for like Michael Stipe's to have like seen Caravaggio and been like I want some of this like going on. There's like that scene with like the girl like posing with like the angel wings at a certain point, and there's like a globe, there's like a bunch of like other thing, even like the golden and dark light that they're both shot in. I just thought that was interesting.
So one thing I know about the Losing My Religion music video is that it's based off of a Gabriel Garcia Marquez short story in some ways, which is called The Very Old Man with Enormous Wings. And what Jarman says about reality and history and historical accuracy, like in that quote that Zach read at the beginning, definitely feels of a piece with the magical realist movement in Latin America. And it would not be surprising if this was like an example of like a, what's the word? Like parallel, like covert convergent evolution in which like magical realism influenced both like this movie and then that, that music video as well. And then they kind of converged on the subject of Caravaggio. I don't know. That's an super interesting point because I've watched that music video like a ton of times.
Oh yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah, I couldn't believe it when I saw it. I was just like, oh yeah, there's that little thing. This is very magically real for sure. I see the magical realism.
Well, I believe it's on Canopy and it's also on Fandor. So if you'd like to check out Caravaggio, you can find them there.
Not Canopy though. Yeah. Or not Canvas.
Not Canvas.
Not Canvas.
All right, well, I'll wrap up this episode of Cinematary. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary, on Twitter and Instagram at @cinematary, and on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/cinematary, where we post all the movies we talked about in this episode. Also, check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/cinematary. Big thanks to our patrons, Cam, Chad Newsom, Christina Daughtry, Corey Willingham, Harry Eskin, Maggie, Ron Hayes, The Kittiest of Kittens, Titus Arthur, Tyler Chandler, and Whitney Rio Ross. Thank you so much for your patronage. Next week, we'll be continuing our Tilda Swinton series with 1992's Orlando, which I think is probably the more well-known early Tilda Swinton movie. So excited to dig into that one. But until then, thank you guys for listening. We'll see you next week.